Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Patrick Flannery, author of I Am No One, published in July by Tim Duggan Books. Patrick is an American writer based in London. His first novel was the award-winning Absolution, and his second was Fallen Land. And now his third novel, the one we'll be discussing today, is I Am No One. Patrick has written for The Washington Post, The LA Times, Newsweek, The Guardian, and many others, and is the professor of creative writing at the University of Reading. So, Jeremy O'Keefe returns to New York and NYU after living a decade at Oxford. He's lonely in his new, but familiar city. He feels as if he could disappear and no one would even know this man who wasn't there. But soon, and to his dismay, Patrick begins receiving unwarranted and frankly scary boxes containing records of items that only he should know about. Comprehensive listings of websites visited, emails sent and delivered, every telephone call he has made and received in the past decade, and he meets a new friend, if you want to call him a friend, Michael Ramsey, who seemingly should not know him and who pops up more than coincidentally everywhere Patrick goes.
Everywhere Jeremy goes.
Jeremy. Sorry. That's exactly what I'm doing. Sorry, I did that twice. Jeremy, not Patrick. He begins to wonder if he has done something wrong, why he should be stalked by a masked figure that acknowledges his presence with a simple nod or wave or shake of the head. More importantly, why would his followers keep him alerted and apprised of the information gleaned and the fact that he has been watched for some time? So as we read on, we watch as Jeremy begins to waver between the thought that he is a wicked criminal and the suspicion that, bluntly, he's going crazy or has incipient early-onset dementia. The book is unnerving and frankly disturbing. The reader follows his first-person account with a growing alarm and the realization that the resolution of this morass of information and perhaps disinformation will never be fully resolved. So with that, welcome, Jeremy, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's good to speak with you.
So one way I knew this was a great book was that after I finished it, I walked around for days feeling that I was being followed and that all my private information had been collated and collected. Of course, I'm already somewhat paranoid, so that's natural. Was that at all your intention to do to me?
I mean, I think that there is a certain impulse in writing the book to try to make people more alert, to the ways in which all the information that they're disseminating through emails and through social media and even through phone calls like this one are accessible to government surveillance, but also to kinds of corporate surveillance that I think we really don't tend to think about.
Well, I started to think about all my postings back in the early 2000s about George Bush and Cheney and Ashcroft and Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
I think I can get away with my rants about Sarah Palin because that's meaningless. But I felt like I needed some kind of medication. And that also seemed as if it was strange. It was almost like a kind of breaking of the fourth wall, in essence. So Jeremy is our sole source of information, and it's told in the first person. So I was forced to recognize as I went through the book that Patrick is either one of the most unreliable narrators of all time, or he's a perfectly... I just wrote that down. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
It's okay.
That Jeremy is one of the most unreliable narrators of all time, or is a perfectly accurate narrator, or that even more disturbing, that he's an amalgam of both. So is the act of observation... Yeah. Okay, go ahead. What do you think of that? How do you feel about it?
No, I think that's a really good reading of it. And, the question is he an unreliable narrator in kind of conventional literary terms? In other words, is he trying to mislead some kind of notional readership, or is he unreliable because he can't actually see the ways in which he's made himself complicit, or is he actually unwell? Is he delusional, and is he unreliable because of that delusion? So the book is kind of forcing readers to ask those questions as they go through it and sort of reach their own conclusions about what can be trusted
Yeah, I know.
In everything that he's reporting.
And he writes as if he doesn't know who the reader will be, almost like a post-apocalyptic writing that when you read this, I may or may not be here, I may not exist, who knows what the world will be like, that kind of thing. So that also adds to the reader's, it's the reader's confusion. It's a good confusion.
Yeah, exactly. Though. Yeah, so he's producing this text and he doesn't know what's going to happen to it as he's composing it. You know, who his readers might be, whether it will be his daughter or his son-in-law or other family members, or if it's going to go to law enforcement or government or perhaps have even wider dissemination.
Well, and you double down because Patrick's academic career is founded in his knowledge and articulation of the Stasi, those informants in East Germany after the war. Perhaps as many as 1 in 10 of the population of the Republic.
Mm.
This alone gives us the idea, well, maybe he's a spy, or that he says he might be one of the world's most renowned experts on a secret organization that Eli Weissel felt was more effective and draconian than the German Gestapo. So, and then I thought of the movie Gaslighting, like, of course, that's probably come up in your talks. And so talk a little bit about the Stasi's tactic of decomposition, the idea of maybe moving a book or removing a glass and putting it someplace else, those kinds of things that they did.
I don't actually know a huge amount about the Stasi. One of the joys of being a novelist is that you can become a kind of mini expert for a brief period of time. But Jeremy, though, as you say, is an expert on the Stasi, and he's certainly referring back to what he understands of their their techniques and that kind of quiet menace in which they could make their presence felt. And it was something that, as I was researching the Stasi, really resonated with memories that I had from my childhood, and especially a period in which it felt as though my parents and my father in particular might be under surveillance because of work that he was doing as an investigative journalist. And there were certain sort of odd occurrences that made us feel as though our home had been accessed by some entity unknown to us. And I think that we always lived with a sort of sense that it could just have been paranoia. It could have been real. But in thinking back to that and thinking about the ways in which the Stasi employed similar kinds of techniques, I felt like there was so much kind of fruitful material for exploring the psychological effects of that experience in light of everything that we know about the sorts of government surveillance that the U.S. has been engaged in, thanks to Edward Snowden.
I guess growing up like that, there must have been a certain amount of, not fear, but apprehension on your part that it really could be happening. So maybe that did give rise to the thought behind this book.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my parents were student activists in the late 1960s in Chicago, and they felt fairly certain that they had been surveilled by the FBI at some point. But I don't think they ever had any firm proof of that. And, I mean, they were very low-level student activists, and my father wrote his doctorate on the press coverage of the riots in Chicago in 1968. But, I grew up with that sense of kind of leftist dissenting life in America. And so that meant that my sense of my own self growing up in America under Reagan was one of always being slightly off-kilter to the mainstream.
It's funny, in the book, and some of these I missed, Jeremy makes reference to a number of eclectic and foreign movies and books, that many of which I didn't know what they were. But there's also references that really made me sit up and wonder, and it's an added element that affects the readers, like the movie The Conversation with Gene Hackman, and that last scene where he's ripping up the floorboards of his apartment, Blow Up, especially when you talk about pixelation later on. Blade Runner, and honestly, as we said briefly before we started talking, before the show, I never thought Deckard was a replicant until Jeremy watches the Nexus 6 cut, which I watched last night, and in which Ridley Scott says, yeah, he's a replicant, but he says it with a smile on his face. And Rutger Hauer says, "Nah, he definitely wasn't." But it's really interesting because I never thought about it, and then that goes back to whether or not Jeremy is what he appears to be, or is he a kind of replicant? And and then I thought, well, like little things would come to my head, like how did Peter and Meredith get where they were so quickly? How is she still in her 20s and has all this? Does this reflect upon Stefan? And you create all these side roads that might very well be true. And I guess as you wrote the book, it must have been very difficult to do this. And I think in one of the reviews, they said you heroically wrote this in the first person. but it's almost, and you probably heard this too, it's almost Kafkaesque, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Kafka is an important touchstone for me as a writer. But I think that I wanted Jeremy to have to sort of be working with the suspicion that there was not, you know, it wasn't just that he was under government surveillance, but that there was even perhaps a kind of much more intimate conspiracy against him. And so that there are these ways in which Meredith, his daughter, and her husband, Peter, seemed to be having this incredibly meteoric career in public life, which seems almost impossible, although there is a kind of suggestion that Peter comes from a family that would have allowed that to be possible.
Yes.
And then Stephen Yeun, who's this colleague at Oxford, who's from the beginning a very sort of menacing figure, but also one who's charismatic and kind of attractive and sort of presents himself as a friend to Jeremy when Jeremy is feeling quite alienated even in Britain. And so as he sort of pieces together all of those elements, I think he's tempted into thinking that there's a kind of a very concerted plot against him. And that's sort of that is one of the symptoms of the paranoid mind, the clinically paranoid mind, is to sort of believe in plots working against you. But ultimately, I think the book doesn't really come down with any conclusive clarity, I guess, about what's going on, because I wanted to leave the way open for another book and to explore some of those things that are only hinted at in the first one.
Yeah, that's what I was I have an independent bookstore, and that's what I was trying to explain to one of my employees, that she was asking me, how does it end? And I said, I can't really tell you how it ends, because... Mm. And this is not a spoiler, because I don't do spoilers, but it's already been reviewed either by Kirkus or some other publication where they say that there's this resounding Joycean Molly Bloom yes at the end of Affirmation. Yeah. And I can see where they say that, and I can see why they say that, but I don't necessarily believe it.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that it's a yes of affirmation. It's a kind of yes of perhaps of determination or of resignation. But it's about leaving the way open for Jeremy to do something more and to think perhaps more clearly about where he's come from and why he is where he is.
There's so many things you do that really make it, it makes me angry. It's like, why is he doing this now? I thought I had it figured out. But like when Stefan always looks apoplectic when Jeremy or Saif say something, and he goes, what are you talking about? I didn't, what do you mean? And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I don't know. Is he really thinking, how dare they? Or is that just a complete ruse or what?
And there's no clear answer.
None.
But
so thanks a lot.
I think but the point, I guess, is to place the reader as closely as possible into Jeremy's own sense of bewilderment. So that's why it's so disturbing and sometimes enraging, because as a reader, you have to rely on him, and you don't understand why people are reacting the way that they are. Or why coincidences seem to happen without any logical explanation. So I'm always interested in the psychological in my books, and in kind of trying to represent realistically psychological processes, and I think that that's part of that.
And you know, in the magical idea of writing, you're on the outside, and you've put me on the inside. And in a first-person account that's done competently, which this is done very competently, you almost turn me... Well, because none of us can ever see what's in anybody's head, except I'm seeing everything that's in his head, which is somewhat Joycean. And so if he is totally unreliable, it's no different than the way many people act today. I mean... Corporations, politicians, this election cycle, they're not telling you, that's not what's in their head, what you're hearing. And so it's not far-fetched at all. But one thing I wanted to tell you, too, with Stefan is that I've been looking for a bottle of, I'll mispronounce it, but that Port Dube scotch, because he loved it so much. I found a UK site where I can get it, but they can't send it to Pennsylvania because it's illegal. But so I've been looking at all the liquor stores. For a bottle of it, so if you could tell me where I could get it.
I don't know where you can get it in the States. Sorry. I'll have to bring a bottle.
Please, you're welcome at my bookstore to sign and bring as many bottles. It's very expensive. But the thing is, that the last scotch, I mean, well, you paint this wonderful picture of paneled walls and a men's club with plush furnishings and leather chairs that are tufted. But then the last scotch you don't name, and that's the one that's the most sublime.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is
it was based on a memory that I had of a 35-year-old scotch that somebody served to me in Oxford. But I didn't know the name of that scotch. And so I was trying to do research, finding a likely candidate, and I couldn't actually find any one that matched my sense memory of all the different senses that I was getting, and so I decided, well, I'm not going to name them. I'm going to report the senses that I remember, and then just to dodge that and not actually give it a name.
There's single malt people and there's not single malt people. It's like I'm not good with beers. I'm not good necessarily with wine, but with single malt scotches, yes, there's definitely. It's perhaps the most evocative type of drink that I've ever had, and you portray that very well in those last two.
Thank you.
Let's see. What other things have you done to irritate me? Let's see. Why does Jeremy treat his mom so badly? He's mean to her.
Interesting. I suppose he is he's short-tempered with her, but has a huge amount of affection for her. And I think that, that experience of great distance, of living at great distance from family members, means that there's always a sort of force of estrangement that occurs, even if we try to maintain contact regularly. You know, if we try to speak on the phone every day or every other day or email regularly, it still happens that there's a kind of distancing. And when you find yourself back in close proximity, close physical proximity with those family members that you live far from, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, across the country or across oceans, in my experience, it always means that you have to go through this really quite protracted process of finding the rhythm of being together again. And so I wanted to think about that sort of the difficulty of that interpersonal contact as being a sort of aspect of Jeremy's character. Which is, I suppose, in a way, it's also tied in with a different kind of surveillance. It's a sort of day-to-day surveillance between people. You know, it's about feeling watched by family members and watching family members. So the book is, you know, it's also interested in those very quotidian ideas of surveillance, not just this kind of grand narrative of surveillance.
And that part of it, you know, when he comes back and everyone, if he goes to Starbucks or someone like something place like that, they'll say, "Are you British?" And you do that a lot in there, like his acquired accent. So I was wondering if that's like semi-autobiographical, that you're... Go ahead.
Yeah. That's the one point of kind of biographical connection, apart from us both having been at Oxford. But I was there as a student, not as a professor. Those moments when Jeremy finds himself in America but no longer taken as American are based to a certain extent on my experiences. Jeremy gets very angry about it. I don't get angry about it. I find it kind of amusing. But I have had conversations where people hear that my mother lives in the States and my parents live in the States. They say, oh, but they're English. They moved there from England. I said, no, they're American. I'm American. And often I've had strangers really not believe me that I'm American. And I have to say to them, you know, I'm actually trying really hard right now to sound as American as possible. And they'll sort of shake their heads and say, it's not working.
It's like when you're talking about House, the guy, Hugh Laurie, and you're saying his accent sounds like it was distilled in a laboratory. So it's not really an American accent. But, of course, I can't see that. I didn't even know he was British at the time. But how did your accent evolve? Because you clearly do sound British.
It's drifted. I've lived in Britain since 2001, and I think there are two kinds of Americans who travel abroad. There are those who manage to, or who live abroad. There are those who manage to live over here for years and years and years and never sound any different. And then there are people like me who transition kind of subtly over time and then end up sounding very foreign at home. I think for me it was about actually responding to fellow students at Oxford who claimed not to understand what I was saying. And I think now that was about kind of policing social codes and wanting me to actually feel out of place. And so as a way of trying not to feel out of place, I adapted my pronunciation kind of subconsciously. And then my husband is South African. And so living with him day to day, I have all of those vowels and that accent working around in my ear. And so some of the vowels have a slightly South African tinge sometimes, by force of kind of, I guess, proximity or something.
Do you feel like Jeremy does, that he was kind of a man without a country? Like in Great Britain, does your accent sound... Do they know you're American automatically, but even though you're speaking to me and you sound British to me? Do they?
Yeah, no. People know I'm American here automatically.
Fascinating. Yeah. And the other side of it is the actual parlance itself, where in the book Jeremy will say "as it were," and Ramsey will go, "Oh, as it were, that sounds," or the word "lovely" instead of "nice," which I find a better word too. Better word as well.
I mean, it's something that I'm conscious of when I'm writing, when I'm trying to write something which is unambiguously American in setting and voice. And I start to worry, is that actually what Americans would say? Or has American speech shifted? Do I know anymore?
Well, you're speaking of Americans in a third person, so.
But I have noticed, and I don't know if this is because of something like BBC America or simply the way that British television has infiltrated American society much more widely than when I was growing up, but I do see American friends on Facebook using British expressions, very clearly British expressions, in ways that I think would have been nearly unthinkable when I was growing up, because it would have appeared so incredibly pretentious. But it seems not to have that same kind of valence of pretension anymore.
I know. It's even when people...
In most circumstances. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and even when Americans first started saying super, or now they say no worries, which really doesn't come from Australia, but, you know, it's like no worries is now like this big, cool thing to say. And it's all part of the homogenization of the world.
It's certainly a kind of radical mixing,
it's funny because one of the things that you do, the book, how can I say this? The book and the subject matter of the book is kind of pixelated. And then you play with that. You play with blow up. You play with pixelation on CCTV, and then you finally play in a really genius kind of way at the gallery, at Meredith's gallery, when you have this essentially a robot creating pixelated sculpture of CCTV images.
Yeah.
And it scares Jeremy, but I don't know exactly what it means. I know it means something, but I don't know exactly what it means. So you tell me.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about that pixelation as a kind of organizing metaphor for the book, but I can see how, you know, there is a way in which he's kind of, if we think of it in visual terms, or in, I guess, in terms of kind of focal distance or something like that. I was never very good at cinematography as an undergraduate at NYU, so my terms are probably completely off. But I guess we could think about the ways in which he's looking at himself and at his memory, and often, you know, the more distant events seem to have greater clarity for him. And it's actually in those moments close to his own time that he becomes less able to see clearly what's happening. So there is a kind of blurring or a kind of pixelation. And, you know, that final thing that you mentioned about the paintings in Meredith's gallery, that was inspired by a real artist whose name I've forgotten, who uses CCTV images, which are then pixelated into these giant canvases. And I can't remember whether he uses a machine or not. I think he may. But I was really interested in that. And I'm, since writing the book, I've discovered all these examples of other artists who are using surveillance or using the kind of possibilities of surveillance for their art. And I think that's totally fascinating. And I guess in a way, if we want to give this book the status of art, which would be nice, it too is trying to think about surveillance, not just as this kind of menacing, horrible thing, but also as possibly a tool for remaking our own aesthetics and for remaking our understanding of the way that we live our lives.
Yeah, and what I was looking at as, which is another way of looking at it, is that pixelation decreases accuracy and the ability to discern what the image actually represents.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of this horrible thing I saw where an American fighter pilot was flying above a field in Afghanistan, and there was somebody running through the field. And he calls his commander and says, there's someone running through a field. It looks like he might have something in his hand. Should we take him out? And the commander says, yeah, go ahead and take him out. And they kill him. And the only knowledge they have is it's a human being running and his hand has something in it. And it's almost as if that's where you're going to a certain extent, because you know, who knows? I mean, and that's the other thing. You keep the reader, you keep veiled a lot of what Jeremy is, we know internally, one step more internally, that he's already has in his mind that we don't yet know.
I see where you're going. I think that, he's kind of conscious of, you know, he's certainly conscious of the ways in which that satellite surveillance is being used to carry out assassinations and battlefield killings through remote unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. But I think that, you know, he also can imagine himself into the subject position of the person who might be targeted. And I wanted to do that too, sort of, you know, to take somebody who objectively looks as though he might, you know, if you passed him on the street, you wouldn't imagine him as anybody who could possibly be a terrorist or anybody who could possibly be linked with terrorism. But it's about the ways in which one can so quickly become situated in a network of connection that the surveilling powers can misread, or they can draw conclusions about our connections that lead them to the wrong conclusions.
Yeah, it's like there's this one book, Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant, and what it is this guy, this poor guy, he's He's not even Muslim, but he's Middle Eastern, and he just happens to meet somebody. This is kind of like what your book talks about. He meets someone in the hallway who happens to be a terrorist, like Saif's brother, and he just talks to him. So then the Americans arrest him and send him to Guantanamo, and every day they bring him a rug so he can pray to Mecca, and he goes, no, but I'm not Muslim. I don't need the rug. And they just keep bringing the rug every day. And it's just this, you know. So Jeremy should have just stayed with Susan, and then you wouldn't have had to write a book.
Things would have been very much, much simpler if he'd got his tenure at Columbia and he'd stayed married to his wife. Yeah.
I like Susan. And they had a nice camaraderie and sense of humor that went back and forth.
Yeah. She's an interesting character, and there's more, I think, to come from Susan if I do, in fact, write a sequel.
Yeah, I think if you do, that there should be, especially the way she gets irritated. Well, that's another thing, too. There's a seminal moment in Jeremy's relationship with this Egyptian woman who's absolutely beautiful, that something happens which is normally earth-shaking, but like much else about the book, Jeremy's emotions, in this case, warm emotions, in other cases, like scared, they don't rise to the level that they would rise in me, of pure panic, of, you know, wanting, and he's able to function normally, notwithstanding the fact that he's getting these three, four boxes that would scare the hell out of me. And I wondered about that. I wondered, it's another one of these labyrinthine things you do to the reader in this book. I wonder, why is he not more upset? Why is he not?
There's something kind of emotionally shut down about him, and I think that's possibly simply about character type. I mean, as I say, he's not me, and so I think I too would be completely freaking out and kind of paralyzed and not really able to function if I was experiencing the same things that he was experiencing, but also simply for the purposes of fiction and momentum of narrative and things like that, I had to have him be at least slightly functioning.
Yeah.
So, you know, he is able to kind of move forward, although he goes through periods of kind of intense anxiety and shock, and he does sort of, you know, he cancels his classes before Thanksgiving, and the bulk of the book really. And the present of the book unfolds over quite a short period of time. You know, it's less than 2 months, really. And he's just reflecting back on these many, many years. So in a way, it does knock him off of his path. But it happens to be the time of year when he can sort of retreat into his apartment and think about what's happening and retreat to his house upstate.
And also, like, in another way, which really makes me think. I read this book in one sitting, and I really, really liked it a lot. But another way in which is even makes it better is that in that one scene with Michael, the third scene when he loses power at his supposed neighbor's house, which I have no idea whether that was true or not. But then Jeremy takes the upper hand for like half an hour. He takes the upper hand, and he knows that he has power, and. And Ramsey is back on his feet. You know, he's off balance. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? You know, seriously, I mean, when a reader thinks, what is the author, what are you doing to me now? So you don't have to give it away if there's anything to give away. But for that brief period of time, when he is rummaging through the drawers for the two flashlights that barely work, and he's not leaving Michael alone, and then he finds the phone and all that kind of stuff. Where did that come from? Because it changed the whole tenor of the book for me. He had power.
Yeah. Well, when I was first thinking about how I was going to write it, I went back and forth between thinking that it was going to be just a first-person book, as it ended up being, or a book that would go back and forth between Jeremy's voice and Michael's voice. And I decided that to do it the way that I wanted to do it, I had to stay exclusively with Jeremy, and that we couldn't really have any outside perspective. But it it meant that I thought quite a bit early on about the kind of person that Michael was. And in presenting him to Jeremy up at, in Rhinebeck at Jeremy's country house, and having that shift in the power dynamic, I wanted to think about some of the impulses that might be driving Michael, if he is in fact who he appears to be, as Jeremy thinks he is. You know, Jeremy thinks that he's this person who's surveilling him, but he's not really sure. And so I wanted to know, you know, as a writer, I was curious about why a character like Michael would potentially be torn by perhaps competing impulses, an impulse both to help or to assist, and even perhaps to protect, and an impulse to pursue. And I think that those are the two things that are sort of tearing Michael apart. For me, he's a conflicted character, and he's also the person that I want to know more about in this potential future book.
And for a reader, he's unreliable too, and meant to be.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
we never really know whether we can trust anything that Michael says.
No. And that, yes, yeah, and those three coincidences are, we know they're not coincidences, but we don't know the reason why they're not.
Yeah.
But then the other thing, the other thing you do is when you, when Jeremy goes off on Howard's End and talks about Vanessa Redgrave's middle finger to her teeth, and he, and how erotic and almost obscene it was, I'm thinking, to use an American colloquialism, this guy is really going off his rocker. I mean, I mean, where is he going with this? And how did that come about? That one paragraph.
Well, I mean, in writing Jeremy's voice, I was trying to, you know, I was trying to find a tone and a mode that would allow me to kind of inhabit this personality who is, on the one hand, kind of pedantic, difficult. I'm sorry, my neighbors are suddenly knocking, hammering on the wall. He's kind of pedantic, he's academic, and then he's also, he is kind of unhinged in a sort of everyday way, not in a kind of clinical way. And so he has these kind of circumambulatory, winding thought processes. And so when I would sit down to write the book, I made the decision at the beginning that I wasn't going to go back and reread anything I'd written unless I forgot what a character was doing, or what a particular relationship was. So I, each day I just wrote forward, and I only went back and reread the entire thing once I had a complete draft. And that meant that I would sit down and try to inhabit Jeremy's psychology, and would often just kind of riff on, you know, things that I thought might occur to him. And so some of those are kind of riffs that are borrowed from my own kind of storehouse, I guess, of cultural knowledge. And so, you know, I remember in that particular moment thinking about Howard's End and thinking about Vanessa Redgrave, and, you know, just it all sort of comes together on the page in a very curious way that I can't totally explain.
No, and I understand it, though. And it's like when Jeremy begins to have his very vivid dreams, almost in a 19 Orwellian way, where you expect him to be going to room 101. And, and then when the doppelganger of Saif says, okay, Jeremy, we can do it this way or we can do it that way. And it reminded me of John Fowle's The Magus, when once again, you have no idea what's going on in that book. And, and you know, he's on trial, essentially. And then, since it was a dream that was not real or could be real, that reminded me, because you reminded me, of Deckard and the unicorns and his dream of a unicorn. And then that came back to the whole replicant thing, none of which you were probably thinking about.
Not quite in that way. But, you know, I think that Jeremy is conscious. He's conscious of the fact that he isn't totally conscious. You know, he doesn't have full understanding of himself, and he doesn't have full understanding of his own position in the world or his position relative to all these people. with whom he has relationships and friendships and acquaintanceships. So he has this kind of suspicion both that he's being plotted against, but also that he might be an agent in a plot of some other design. You know, so it is very destabilizing, I know. But I think I think it's something that perhaps a surprisingly large number of people might feel, you know, too, that life is not really knowable and our place in the world is not really knowable. We kind of move through life thinking that we know what we're doing and we know who our friends are and we know what our relationships are and we know what our profession is and what our point is in the world, or we think we do. And then something small can sort of throw us off balance and suddenly we begin to question our place and what we're doing and whether we're doing the right thing. And so the book is kind of a magnification of very ordinary paranoias about purpose and kind of existential questions too, I guess.
Well, before I began this litany of all the things that you did to throw me off my game, in the beginning, when the email that he either wrote or didn't write, that begins to bother him, and he tells his daughter and son-in-law, and I'm thinking, this is very nice. They tell him, maybe you should see someone. No, Dad, there's nothing wrong with you. Has this ever happened before? No. And then he immediately compliantly goes to the doctor. Everything's fine. But I'm thinking, this is going to be a commonplace type book. This is going to unfold. And but it doesn't at all. But his compliancy, it wasn't fear, but he just wanted to, like, do some type of essentially a reality check, which is what this book really is. He wanted to go to the doctor as a reality check. And then he brings her...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's totally irrelevant, but then he brings her a bottle too. You're not supposed to bring a gift to your psychoanalyst, Herman.
Yeah, so, I mean, he turns to medicine hoping for, as you say, a reality check or kind of confirmation that he isn't ill. And in a way, if he were ill, it would almost be more reassuring because then there would be an explanation.
Exactly.
And there is no explanation.
One time I was in therapy and at Christmas time, I brought my therapist a bottle of wine and he took it and he looked at it and then he just handed it back to me.
You were breaking the therapeutic contract.
Yeah, and you know what? I really admired him for that.
That's great.
Well, so you met... Oh, and the other thing is Edward Snowden. You do mention him once, and the book is really in the here and now. The book is like you're reading about what happened yesterday, which was horrible. So it's almost like the book is written today, like literally today. Mm. And you do mention Edward Snowden, but only once, and at the very end, does his actual name appear. But a lot of what you've written here arises from the actions he took, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I sat down to write it, I didn't think I must write a post-Snowden novel. I was thinking about all these other issues, about kind of aging and family and interpersonal watching and, the way that New Yorkers live these kind of half-public lives, you know, standing in their apartments, not really conscious of the way that people in other apartments might be looking at them. So I wanted to think about all those things and also to try to write a book that would allow me to bridge my own experience in Britain and New York and to sort of make sense of my own kind of mixed feelings about alienation and migration. And as I worked my way into the character and thought about a kind of, you know, a first moment in the book, I thought increasingly about surveillance and decided that was really what the book was about. It was about both kind of government and corporate surveillance, but also about these very ordinary day-to-day acts of people watching each other and the way that we get watched in society. And sort of accustom ourselves to being watched from a very young age.
Yeah, it's like somewhere in the book you were talking about people saying, I don't care if I'm being watched. I don't do anything wrong. I'm happy that I have no privacy. I think it's good for the country, just like maybe Donald Trump might say. But so to put you on the spot then, what are your feelings about the actions that Edward Snowden took? Because I'm more than happy to say that I think they were heroic.
I mean, I'm extremely grateful for what he did. I think that the kind of doctrinaire legal side of me would say, well, he probably should have his day in court. He should answer to the laws that he broke. At the same time, that I think that if there was a case, he should come out of it without any kind of sanction. You know, I think that what he did was incredibly important. But I know that lots of people don't feel that way as well. But I think that, you know, given the kinds of moves that we've seen, even in the last few weeks in Congress, which would seem to be moving us backwards towards even more intrusive surveillance, and certainly the kinds of moves here in Britain that Theresa May, the Home Secretary, is envisioning, will move towards very intrusive surveillance. So I think, you know, if we hadn't had Snowden, it would have been possible, or somebody like Snowden, you know, if he himself hadn't existed. But if we hadn't had that moment of global wake up to what was happening, it would have been incredibly easy for us to sleepwalk into a state of total surveillance. And I think, without really thinking about what the implications are for selfhood and subjectivity and freedom of speech, I think because of him, we have the opportunity now to be alert to what's happening and to insist on safeguards being put in place for our privacy. That sounds naive too, because I also don't believe that safeguards will necessarily make us safe. But I think that, you know, we have to be conscious citizens who demand something better from our governments and from the corporations too that are providing us with all these very seductive devices and platforms that in fact are also eroding our privacy.
The problem is the same as the situation that the East Germans found themselves in. It's the question of what power do we actually have to stop what's going on, especially if we don't know.
I don't know that we do have any power, but we can certainly make noise.
What do you think Snowden does every day in Russia anyway?
I imagine that he's online all the time.
Yeah, me too.
Either answering emails, writing emails, or reading the news.
Do you think he's like treated as a hero? Do you think he goes to lunch with? I just have this feeling, and it's like when I think about soldiers in Afghanistan. I don't know what they do when they wake up in the morning.
I don't know. I don't have any sense of what his day to day life is like. There was that really interesting piece.
Yeah.
That was published earlier this year by Arundhati Roy and John Cusack, which was kind of, you know, they went into his hotel room and spent some hours with him. But, you know, he does seem to be living in this kind of state of sort of suspended existence. I can't imagine that the Russians are incredibly welcoming, because it would seem to me that he would be just as interested in revealing what they're up to. I don't know. It must be a very strange existence.
Yeah, it must be. Well, so you did mention the possibility of a sequel. It seems like I would love if there was a sequel, but it seems like it would have to be as if you were writing a Tolkien trilogy. It would have to be like the Two Towers. I mean, because it would have to begin where it left off, I think.
Yeah. No, I am thinking about three books in total. And I think I'm beginning to have an idea of what the second book might look like. But I'm kind of waiting for the next year to see what direction the world is headed in. I really could not have predicted the Brexit vote here. And I think that, you know, that kind of world historical shift is something that would certainly impinge on Jeremy's sense of his own place in the world. So I think that those sorts of things have to feed into whatever comes next.
Well, if the worst happens in America in November, you'll definitely have lots of fodder for the sequel, unfortunately.
Exactly, and that is, of course, the other major thing that I'm holding my breath about.
You just have to promise me that if you do a trilogy, that at the end of the trilogy, I will know what the hell is going on.
I promise.
Okay, well, with that, I'm much happier, although I think it'll still take me a couple of days to kind of calm down. But I might need some type of medication, maybe scotch. But I really loved your book. As I said, I have a bookstore. If you're ever in the United States and near Philadelphia, I would love to have you come and do a signing or when the paperback comes out. But it was a pleasure talking to you, and I really, really enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you, too. I've got friends in Philly, so I'll have to come.
Okay, definitely. I look forward to it.
Good.
You can bring
Thanks a lot.
You can bring the bottle yourself.
Okay.
We were speaking with Patrick Flannery, and I called his character Jeremy Patrick several times. I don't know why. That was something psychological with me. But I didn't expect it to be as good as it was. And it was one that I read in one sitting. And it's incredibly topical, but that's not what its genius is. Its genius is in the idea of portraying somebody, as I said, in a Kafkaesque way or in a Dostoevsky type of way, or in a Joycean type of way, where you're basically living inside of somebody's head for all the pages that are in the book. And even though you are, you have no idea whether the resolution that seems to be happening is actually happening in reality. And I love those kinds of books because it leaves me tons of room in which to write the ending or to write the new beginning as if there is a sequel. So I would highly recommend it, Patrick Flannery's I Am No One. And coming up we have, I mean, we're so way out there in terms of broadcasts that we have a list of so many that I'm not even going to go into it, but we have a lot of really National Book Award potential finalists, Pulitzer Prize potential finalists or winners, as we've had before many times, thanks to my producer Rebecca Albright's ability to nail down these authors for appearances on the show. So I really enjoyed my talk with Patrick, and next week please join us for another edition of The Avid Reader.